And so if anyone is in the wrong session, this is your chance to get up and move.
Don't you dare.
The tapes for this session will be available, and I gather that you can get them quite soon after the session. So if they say anything really memorable today that you want to save, then it'll be your chance. Our first speaker, the paper that you'll be hearing today, the Mormon Art and Belief Movement, will be presented by Vern Swanson, who is the director of the Springville Art Museum of Art. He's a graduate of BYU and the University of Utah. He's also a PhD student at the University of London. And he's worked at the National Gallery of Art. And he was associated as a fly on the wall, he said, to the Mormon Art and Belief Movement. And so he's going to tell us all about it today. The person commenting on the paper is Dennis Smith, who is entering his 22nd year of his career as a nationally prominent sculptor and painter. His works are on prominent display in 13 states and the American embassies in both Moscow and London. He is represented by 21 galleries and in 1989 alone unveiled 16 new life-sized works for an airport in South Carolina, a library in Iowa, and an office building in California and Missouri. He was raised in Alpine, Utah, and was a graduate of Brigham Young University and attended the Royal Academy of Art in Copenhagen. And he has lots of other honors. Plus, he writes a column in the Deseret News, which I'm sure we've all read many times and enjoyed. And we're it's very nice to have him here today to comment on the paper. And the process will be today that Vern will take about a half hour to read his paper, and then Dennis will take about 15 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes to comment, and then our question and answers will be at the end. So if you have any questions, save them till the end. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's an honor to speak before you about a subject that means a lot to me, and particularly in front of two of the four major participants. And let me introduce Gary Smith. Right there. He's mentioned in the paper today and is a major participant in the Mormon Art and Belief Movement, The Wise Hearts. The death in May of 1990 of Dale Thompson Fletcher has caused me to reflect on the 25-year history of the Art and Belief Movement. Fletcher had galvanized around himself a talented coterie of artists, mostly converts to Mormonism, whom he inspired with his theories of an art dedicated to God. Dennis Smith, one of the leading participants of the movement, remembers. He touched something that was there, that was already there, just under the surface. For some, he struck a spark. For others, he touched a nerve. While important LDS artists had earlier visualized the Mormon epic, they had done so individually and usually independently. From the first and second generations of the Art and Belief Movement, that would be between 1965 and 1978 when Dale Fletcher left Utah, it has continued to grow and to spread with regular impulses in ripple-like fashion. Today, though strongest in central Utah, the Art and Belief Movement, along with Utah landscape painting, is the most significant indigenous contribution the state has made to American art. And I might say, it's my opinion, that it is the most important art movement that has happened in the history of Utah art. The Brigham Young University had always been a hotbed for artists seeking to paint their religion. A proto-LDS movement of sorts in this direction took place with J. Roman Andrus, Alex B. Dureas, and Franz Johansson during the late 50s and early 60s. But all this is history. This may be considered history or initial to the real flowering of the visionary and spiritualist art in Utah. Earlier artists were involved in spiritualist art, but they did not have the critical mass of artists to produce enough works to merit being called an art movement. Such an art may be divided into a pre-1966 and a post-1966 eras. The addition of the painter Dale Thompson Fletcher in the fall of 1965 noticeably changed the Brigham Young University art department. Hired from being a custodian and elementary teacher, he came to the department as an instructor of art and art history. Once in Provo, he became the pivotal character of the drama which profoundly affected the arts of Utah and the lives of many. The complexity of this man and the significance of the art and belief movement now need to be told in their fullest. Fletcher was born in Logan on the 21st of February, 1929, the 10th of 14 children of Calvin Fletcher and Irene Thompson. His noted father for many years had been Utah's most impassioned advocate of modernist trends in art at Utah State University. Undoubtedly because of this influence, Dale enrolled at the University of California in Berkeley for graduate work. As a non-objective painter, he received his MA degree in 1956. As early as an abstract expressionist as we have in Utah, he proved his abilities through paintings such as Lifting by Leverage from 1956 in the Springville Museum Collection and Big Black in 1956 in the Family Collection. Shortly thereafter, the Fletchers moved from Berkeley to River Heights, which is between Logan and Providence, Utah, in Cache County. In 1957, the Utah Arts Institute, that would be the Utah Arts Council, selected him as one of five artists to win a special merit award in the professional modern category. They no longer have that category, by the way. This success was, however, short-lived. A couple of years later, while painting an abstract, a dark spot on the canvas riveted his attention, and as he painted, it got bigger, with creeping black consuming the piece. Finally, the painting was almost entirely black, and a la Ad Reinhardt, an abstract expressionist from the period, he intuitively glued a plastic sheep and titled it Bezaleel, after the Old Testament artisan. After this eerie experience, which frightened him very much, he never again painted a non-objective painting. Suddenly, he began to draw in Indian ink naturalist studies of weedy fields and gardens. Fletcher had his own abstract Hans Hofmann era period at Berkeley, but by the early 60s, he converted to a Heinrich Hofmann naturalism in his own paintings as one who had been born again. He had profoundly undergone a spiritual metamorphosis. The family moved to Salt Lake in the fall of 1961, where Dale taught at Granite High School for 2 years. In 1963, he left his teaching job and worked as a custodian for a year. Why he quit is vaguely understood, except that he had been teaching high school for 6 years and he needed a sabbatical to work out some inner necessities. According to the minutes of the Art and Belief group, he tried to discover what would be significant for him to do as an artist. It was during this period that Brother Fletcher, to quote the minutes, was working as a custodian that he formulated the following criteria for what would a Mormon art be like. He listed 11 elements which were used like a manifesto by the Art and Belief movement 3 years later. And let me name the 11 elements to you. Developed in 1963 and then later used in 1966 when the movement actually began to take on more formal focus. One, it would be produced sacramentally as an act of praise and devotion and be dedicated to the upbuilding of the kingdom of God on earth. Two, it would arise from the artist's faith in the essential value which is in all things. Three, it would include genuinely moral subject matter to influence man for good. 4. It would not be slight or superficial, but would pursue nature to the full limits of human capability and ever push back those limits. It would be a wholehearted endeavor. And Dale used to use the word earnestness, I remember, quite a bit at this time. 5. It would strive to reveal the joyful, wholesome beauty which is already in the living entities of nature, rather than to consider nature only as a source of motifs that must be designed or redesigned by the artist in order to make art. 6. It would be outgoing, expansive, purposeful, not morbid, ingrown, exhibitionistic, or perverse. It would be depictions of truth first and decorative objects only incidentally. 7. The emotions will be controlled for good purpose, yet they will be as intense as in expressionism. 8. The Mormon artist's confidence would increase because he has purpose. He would not forever stand beneath the old masters of Matisse, Picasso, and Rembrandt, glancing furtively over the shoulder at them. He would enjoy the respect. He would enjoy and respect their achievements, but he would dare to go on and produce new works of art, kinds of art that would thrill mankind and establish faith. 9. The Mormon artist would thus earn a right to the material needs of himself and his dependents by performing a function accepted as beneficial to good society. 10. In his relationship with artists of different viewpoints than his own, he would, paraphrasing the Articles of Faith, claim the right to paint according to the dictates of his own conscience and allow all men the same privilege. And finally, 11, the joy that comes from whole-souled participation in the best cause in the world would stimulate the artist to achieve feats of painting not possible with a slighter motivation. The people would begin to open their eyes, and the critics would, at last, close their mouth. Okay, the early stages of the art and belief movement were patterned after the above precepts as outlined by Fletcher at the time. While a full-time custodian, he painted a large apple tree, 1963, one of his first treehouse paintings, which was the leading motif and subject that Dale Fletcher was known by. The oldest one was in the State Collection, 1961. It was later seen by Conan Matthews, Dean of the College of Art, Fine Arts at the BYU, who invited him to apply for a position at the university. And on the 1st of September, 1965, Fletcher was hired at the BYU as an instructor in art. Shortly after beginning fall semester in 1965, Fletcher was driving to teach an extension class at Roosevelt, Utah. A car accident which killed a deer and nearly himself left Fletcher shaken. He seems to have begun, after recovery, to sense the immediate importance of dedicating one's talent as an artist to the building up of the kingdom of God. His spiritual odyssey, intellectual and psychological, tended to swing between periods of anxiety and certainty. Though a quiet man, he was possessed by a mission to rescue art from the quixotic ruminations of the avant-garde apostates. Another of the catalyzing forces injected into the BYU Art Department during the summer of 65 was the Rhodesian Trevor Jack Thomas Southey, who had earlier studied at the Royal Brighton College in Sussex and in South Africa. He sailed to New York from England in time to see the World's Fair. There he saw the Catholic Pavilion with its marble sculpture by Michelangelo titled the Pietà, and the Mormon Pavilion with its oils by Harry Anderson. The contrast angered and frustrated Southey, who asked, "Why can't we have a great Mormon artist?" Upon arriving in Provo, he visited with J. Roman Andrus and discussed the problem. Andrus, who was a professor at the in the art department at the BYU, noted that this had been discussed for decades and that Harry Anderson was a Seventh-day Adventist and not even a Mormon. Infuriated, Southie, sometime later, contacted Mark E. Peterson of the Quorum of 12, who felt that Southie was being just a little bit self-serving by bringing his attention to this problem. Elder Peterson said that the reason they hired Harry Anderson was, when we ask for a blue shirt, we get a blue shirt. To Southie, insipidness had supplanted inspiration by professional illustrators who were, according to him, nothing more than latter-day hirelings. Peterson recommended that Southie contact Evans Advertising in Salt Lake, the LDS Church's art arbitrators at the time. Later, he took them a reproduction of his large Capita opera, The Plan, BYU 1966 from the BYU collection, and was asked to do a first vision with Joseph Smith, not as a humble farm boy, but rather in his best clothes. They asked Southie to research clothing of the day, right down to the buttons, and make it an historically accurate costume painting. Again, he was infuriated and declared, quote, if we are to have our own art, we can't go directly to the church. We must work independently. To a great degree, it was Southie's passion and brashness that something must happen that served as a catalyst for the beginning of the Mormon art movement. At Brigham Young University in the New Harris Fine Arts Center, in January of 1966, the enigmatic Dale Fletcher held court. Around him had galvanized a number of the brightest art students, fired by the idea of a religious art for our time, a great art expressing the truths of Mormonism. Much of what Fletcher expressed about Mormon art was in his classes and in private. Then later, in group discussions, when they realized that there was broad interest in the subject. During the spring semester of 1966, many figure drawing sessions, numerous informal discussions and conversations were held questioning, what is Mormon art? Many student artists from the graduate painting lab, The Cave, were attracted to Dale Fletcher's lectures on the subject. During this period of the Vietnam War, hallucinatory drugs, psychedelic art, and student unrest began a movement focusing on the expression of the spiritual nature of the gospel. A number of students were seized by the excitation of those heady days. With Fletcher, graduate art students such as Dennis Smith, Trevor Southie, Gary Smith, Grant Lund, Larry Presswich, Gerald Pearson in theater, and Carolyn Pearson in poetry formed the nucleus of the movement. Fletcher remembered those early days. Quote, Larry Presswich had just exhibited a series of drawings based on the Book of Mormon, was talking to Trevor Southie, a Rhodesian who had recently joined the church, about the prospect of a new distinctively LDS art. And Larry finally suggested, let's have an exhibition. Southie had, the young art student from Alpine, Utah, Dennis V. Smith, towards the end of the spring semester of 1966, invited a group of LDS artists and writers to his off-campus apartment in Provo for a heartfelt discussion on what Mormon art should be. Plans were laid for an exhibition at the Salt Lake Public Library in December of 1966. The exhibition was originally entitled A Light for the Kingdom, but was changed to Art and Belief before the call for entries were mailed. The prospectus announced, quote, an art exhibition based on Mormon religious philosophy will be held the month of December in Salt Lake City. Work is being sought that specifically reflects the Latter-day Saint ideology, Work of a more universal nature can only be accepted when it has obviously been executed with the vehemence and intensity of purpose peculiar to the Latter-day Saint concept of life. The question, quote, what is the relationship of our aspirations as artists to our faith as members of the Mormon Church, was uppermost in their minds and art. It was felt by those present that a grand vista was about to unfold. The brochure for the exhibition noted, quote, the key element which we do all agree upon is that a Mormon art should be produced almost sacramentally as an act of praise and devotion and be dedicated to the upbuilding of the kingdom of God on earth. We believe that this should not restrict the individual from working as he feels appropriate in attempting to present the idea which he or she specifically wishes to convey. After about 6 months of preparation, more than 50 works of art were exhibited at the Salt Lake Public Library by two BYU instructors, that's Dale Fletcher and Larry Presswich, three graduates, Dennis Smith, Stan Wanless, and Carolyn Pearson, and five undergraduates, Trevor Southey, Leon Fletcher, Michael Graves, Gary Smith, and Michael Coleman. A review in the Sunday Herald revealed that the exhibition satisfied, quote, the artist's need to reflect their religious beliefs in art whenever possible. Art and belief will give each of the artists an opportunity to express his own personal feelings about Latter-day Saint theology. And to quote, they quote Trevor Southey, we hope to bring the church's view, we hope to help the church's views become known by bearing our testimonies through our art, said Trevor Southey. Either Mormon art was an idea whose time had come, or those involved were particularly adept at creating attention, or both, because they quickly began to be noticed. Dialogue, the Journal of Mormon Thought, in their first issue after the close of the Art and Belief exhibition, that would be December of 66 to January of 67, published an article by Dale Fletcher and Douglas Hill on the show. Fletcher reviewed the movement over the past 2 years and its raison d'etre, while Hill critiqued the exhibition for not providing a cohesive enough statement. Hill felt, that it was presently impossible to have such an identifiable statement because there was not yet a strong visual art tradition in the Mormon Church. Many subsequent meetings at the homes of Fletcher and Provo, Gary Smith in Vineyard, then in Alpine, and Dennis Smith in Provo, then at the Chicken Coop studio in Alpine, I think, okay, further helped to identify and organize the movement. Involved in those early meetings were Grant Lund, Larry Presswich, Gerald and Carol Lynn Pearson, and the author Vern Swanson as the fly in the wall. Some felt that a set of distinctively Mormon iconographs would soon emerge. Once invoked, these images would begin to predominate the individual styles of each artist to such a degree that the label Mormon art would be clear and discernible. Others, such as Dennis Smith, maintained that, quote, each artist must find his own way to produce that which is most meaningful to him, rather than to expect the emergence of a common style. Trevor Southey felt that the work of art should be communicative to all, so as to enlarge faith and the appreciation of Mormonism. Gary Ernest Smith noted, quote, it must be emphatic enough to capture people's attention, interesting enough to hold it, and significant enough to deserve it. All felt that the movement would contrast with the prevailing negative spirit and tyrannical hegemony of the art of that time, such as pop art, op, minimal, kinetic, conceptual, auto-destructive art, the brutalist arts of the period. Shy and gentle, Dale Fletcher was intensely spiritual and introspective. His enigmatic personality quickly built a following among some of the art students in the department. A man of cosmic causes, he shortly became the father of the nascent art Mormon art movement. Fletcher, the Fra Savonarola of Utah art, railed against the decadence and the secularism of modernism. He conceded that the art of this period was facing still more avant-garde aggressions. Quote, "And we are brought at length to open surrender to the predicament, to the black square, the soup can, the raw portrayal of sexual confusion, and the twiddling of the optical nerve." As an antidote to the factionalism of contemporary isms, Fletcher searched the past for epics where spirituality and religion played an integral part in the lives of artists. He taught that by studying these periods and practicing one's art purposefully and prayerfully, that a uniquely Mormon style would emerge. Like the Pre-Raphaelites, he revolted against the pathetic fallacy of the triviality and decadence of the art of their age. This new Latter-day Saint movement was to rally all wise-hearted artists to the true faith. Fletcher was fond in quoting this from the book of Exodus. Quote, "Then wrought Bezalel and Aholiab and every wise-hearted artist in whom the Lord put wisdom and understanding to know how to work all manner of work for the service of the sanctuary, according to all the Lord hath commanded, in whose heart the Lord hath put wisdom, every one whose heart stirreth him up to come to the work to do it." Exodus 36, verses 1 and 2. The movement was based in part on the calling of two ancient Hebrew artisans, Bezalel and Aholiab, to create cunning and curious works of art for the tabernacle in the desert. Their dedication to the work of the Lord and their humility, note that they weren't called artists, but they were called, but rather workmen, served as exemplars for the work of Latter-day Saint artists. Gary Smith's canvas, Steps of Conversion, 1968, from the Springfield Museum collection, reveals the image of a seeing heart near its signature as a token of the painting's religious intention. And if you'll look behind you on the west wall, you'll see the painting, Steps of Conversion, which the museum just recently acquired. In the upper right-hand section, you'll see a seeing heart. Which is a symbol of the seeing heart and wise hearts that are mentioned in the book of Exodus. Attention was paid particularly to early Italian primitive art like Giotto, Fra Angelico, and Botticelli, etc. These artists supposedly had, according to Fletcher, pure intent by prayerfully offering up their talents to the glory of God. Unlike the later excesses of the High Renaissance or the Mannerist and mannerism, they were true believers. The attempt to restore the truth, purity, and character of the pre-Renaissance art endeared the Nazarenes of Bavaria to Fletcher. The calculated naivete and naturalism of the English Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood were also to be studied and emulated. What Dale Fletcher really wanted was a breakaway group who would separate themselves from the world and paint their millennial world into existence. Fletcher saw himself as a Latter-day Bengali, like John Ruskin had been to the Pre-Raphaelites, who would lead the way towards a spiritual art against the trivialities of the day. Coming out of Babylon was a lesson that he often taught. Fletcher saw himself leading the talented innocents into the desert, and there under his aegis they would eventually return triumphant. Though being carefully selective, Fletcher felt that the neo-Catholic and Nabi movements, as espoused by Maurice Denis and Paul Serussier, were of some importance. It basically integrated the dynamic symmetry of monk Desiderius with the innovations of early modernism. Though today all these revivalist movements seem a little pedantic to the general public, for these crusaders it was alive and fresh. Fresh and alive. It was all the rejection of the perceived cynicism and turbulence of the 1960s that Mormon art and belief movement was seen as a viable alternative. Fletcher's injunction of an adequate raison d'etre into art was pursued by Dennis Smith. Dennis's work at the Danish Academy strengthened his resolve to add purpose to his art. He wrote Trevor Southey in January of 1968, noting, "There must be a purpose, and present purposes are so weak. The avant-garde in America and the repercussions of it in Europe are so without purpose. Profound, I admit, but of no purpose. This is not art, it is absurdity. Trevor, we must give people answers. Answers everything." He brought, by December of 1968, the need of studying the ancient Egyptian and archaic Greek canons to the attention of his students. Fletcher's search for dynamic divine symmetry and sacred geometry had just begun. He came to this study through his interest in Egypt, in the canons of proportion. The study of the golden section, the golden mean, squaring the circle, and the sacred cut, etc., became an important ingredient in his view for Mormon art. It would, he felt, separate Latter-day Saint artists from the general morass of Gentile art. It would also, he also professed the power of the symbol and the sign, both overt and latent, as a major tool of expression for the true artist. Finally, he advocated a boldly observed naturalism, but this was implemented by most members of the group with more illusion than illusion, however. Because of their travels, many of the first phase art and belief artists did not become deeply involved with dynamic symmetry and sacred geometry. Dennis Smith saw it as something good to know, as a confirmation of eternal principles, as a tool if you chose to use it. Trevor saw it more as a compositional device without exploring its more mystical implications. Gary Smith would return in January of 1970 from Korea, where he was in the army, and become the first to wholeheartedly adopt symmetry and geometry in his work for a few years. Gary Smith seems to have taken most of these principles of the movement further than he went so far as to devise an alphabet and symbols to enrichen the visual and theological content of his work, such as his Egyptian-based canvas, Joseph Confronting His Critics, from 1970. The sacred and royal cubits were the standards for the ancient measurement and the key, Fletcher felt, to unlocking the mysteries of the demiurge. Something that would reverberate sync with the universe. He searched for the meaning of the word cubit in all references and found that that most were related to his Egyptian studies. He got into pyramidology by looking into the meaning of the cubit at the BYU library, first with Francis M. Darter's The Bible of Stone. How are we doing? Okay, that's perfect. Okay. Darter's Our Bible in Stone, and then the more scholarly work of Adam Rutherford dealing with the Great Pyramid of Giza. Eventually, his research and personal revelations in this area led him away from Mormonism. Yet, his academic career continued unabated, and he was promoted to the position of assistant professor at the BYU in 1970. The movement now needed to work upon a larger platform than it had previously operated. A letter to the Art and Belief movement, a letter from Art and Belief member Grant Lund to the Dean of the College of Fine Arts and Communications, Lauren F. Wilwright, in 1968 might have spurred this process. The institutionalization of the movement in 1969 by Dean Wheelwright changed things for good and ill. A totally different personality from the self-effacing, awkwardly shy, and whispering Dale Fletcher, the musician Wheelwright was more dominating and aggressive. Up to this time, there had been a stony silence from both the BYU administration and the LDS Church with regard to the art that was being produced by these young artists. Wheelwright saw the festivals, a Mormon festival of arts, as saw its potential and began to capitalize on it by organizing a festival at the college rather than departmental level. He tried to refine and give definition to the movement, but defined it in his own image. The first was held in 1969 and was very successful enough to hold subsequent ones in 1970. And the last one, I believe, occurred just before the death of Cliff Allen in 1982 or 3. Arts Festival 1971 grew to include music, drama, creative writing, dance, and cinema. Saudi felt that this was a healthy extension, but others felt it lost its focus. After this auspicious beginning, the art and belief movement is now entering into a crisis period. By the fall of 1971, Fletcher was alternating between bouts of apostasy and discovery. And to quote him, "I have learned more about the Bible in the 2 years since I discovered pyramidology than in the 20 years before. Yet, I must play like I am blind to it all, or must conclude that Mormonism is false." Dale Fletcher continued in the art department for another 6 years, becoming more and more isolated as his own interest moved towards a millenarian research on the Great Pyramid and the erotic scriptures of the Songs of Solomon. By 1972, the major players had all graduated and left the BYU, except Trevor Southey, who was on the faculty. They all had been groping as young students before this time, and Fletcher had helped galvanize them into a formidable force in Utah art. All would attain national stature in the visual arts, and all credit Fletcher as a mentor who helped to give direction to their talents. As they began to have their own careers and families. The art and grief belief movement, which they had established, had acted as a stabilizing influence on their lives. Most concurred with Gary Smith's declaration, quote, "I feel the need for combining religion and art. I can give thanks to Dale Fletcher for his scholarly approach to proving verbally our related ideas. He has done more than anyone in motivating and influencing me." To many, millennial art seemed just a few years away. However, by the mid-1970s, after nearly a decade of searching for an archetypal Mormon idiom, some of the artists began to find other content subjects and philosophical directions. Interestingly, some of those originally associated with the movement lost faith in the Church of Jesus Christ, from whence had come the inspiration for the movement in the first place. Like the short-lived Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood of the 19th century, the art and belief movement continued to inspire in ripple-like fashions the arts of Utah to the present day. Thank you very much.
I'll try to be as brief as possible so we can have time for questions. For sure, I wish we had 3 or 4 hours, though. As Vern was talking, he quoted a letter that I wrote when Valoy and I were living in Copenhagen, and I wrote a letter to Trevor and said, "We must bring people answers." That hit me when you said that. It's interesting, as time has gone on over the years, and I have reflected, I realized that what has happened in my life, and I think this is typical of us in lots of our lives, we notice as time goes on that we have less answers, and yet things seem a lot more sensible to us as we become less dogmatic and more aware of all of the grays that affect our lives. And yet, I really think that, in a sense, this hour today is kind of a homage to Dale and the vision that he triggered in us. Unequivocally, at that time, we were at a point where we were hungry to find certain focus, and Dale was a part of that focus. I had a whole bunch of things I wanted to mention, but I think the best way of doing it... I don't have a lot to comment on in terms of critique of, or that kind of comment of Vern's paper. I didn't think I'd have to talk at all, in fact, because as of 2 weeks ago, when I was trying to drag it out of him, and I didn't get the paper until a few minutes before the thing started, but I knew what it was all about because I was in close contact with him. But about 2 weeks ago, he had it up to 35 pages, and he said he was going to get it down to 9, and day before yesterday he had it up to 50. So we can so he's been trimming and pruning the last couple of days. But it, what has been most interesting about this last month or so, as Gary and I have been talking with Vern, is you become so conscious of how your life, the historical context of our lives. You know, we look back on that, and as you listen to it, it sounds like history, and yet it wasn't any different to us then as this meeting, as what we're saying to one another now. And 20 years from now, people will talk about the day when such and such was said at the Sunstone Symposium in 1991. And I think one of the profound things that is important for us to realize is that we are living, what we are living has so much poignance to it when it happens to us. And that's what I really appreciated very much this last month about Vern's intensity and commitment to follow and search out these roots, is that there was something that we didn't even understand that was happening, and yet Vern had the perception and the clarity to be able to pull it together. One of the things he asked me to do, and I'd like to just close my comments by doing this, reading some portions of this, is about 2 weeks ago he asked Gary and I to write down some brief statements about what we saw that we gained from that movement. And I think that the most clear way of expressing how I feel would be to just read what I wrote and sent to Vern 2 weeks ago as he was preparing his letter. Regarding the art and belief movement of the late 60s and early 70s, you asked me how I saw myself in it and what I saw as my contribution. First, I think we were all thrown together by an intense bonding of mutual support for our insecurities about diving into the unknown of art, which we as students had a very strong commitment toward. I mean, we didn't have any sort of a background or security. I mean, there weren't any professional artists living in Utah at the time. And I mean, and we were kids that were scared spitless about entering the world and becoming artists, and there was just a lot of fear attached to that. Yet you could hardly have asked for more different people as far as backgrounds were concerned. The draw toward one another had to be very strong to make a bonding occur. I mean, Gary was from Oregon, and Trevor was from South Africa, and I was from Utah, and Grantland, and I mean, we're so totally diverse. We had nothing in common other than our art. We have often observed and acknowledged those differences and were amazed at the time that despite them there was a unique binding force. So I asked myself, what was it? For me, it had a lot to do with approval. I had grown up in a culture in which conformity was vital, a small Mormon one-ward community, Alpine. From the time I was small, I sensed I was different and saw things different than others in my surroundings, but I always, instead of assessing that sensitivity or sensibility as special, defined it as shameful. My feelings were just enough out of kilter with prevailing perspective to be sensed as out of line. A sense of wonder was not a high priority in a farming community that had instilled a century of Brigham Young's pragmatism and general Mormon cultural distrust of the world outside. You know that feeling of the world outside, the mission field? I grew up with these notions. I distrusted them. Yet I also distrusted my distrust. A volatile personal cauldron of feeling, anxious for exploration and emotional support for that. Let me go on to the move. Then there were people who distrusted the movement, distrusted what we were doing. One of those that I think prime was Neil Hadlock, who has been a close friend for all of these years. And at that time, I have always seen my passion mirrored in Neil. Yet while his bohemianism went one way, seeking fulfillment in contemporary idioms, my bohemian nature turned inward, not just personally, but intercultural, if that makes any sense. That's why Neil and I were at odds all the time. We were always screaming at one another. We saw each other in each other and were threatened by what the other symbolized about ourselves. Or rather, we felt self-conscious that we were not focusing on what the other was, but there was nothing to do about it, but rail against one another and try to justify the route we had each personally taken, needlessly at odds. With time, we recognize this and have come to terms with it as we've matured. To the movement, Neil was a devil's advocate sort of guy. A valuable voice of warning from the wastelands of contemporary poetic sensibility. I mention this because it helps me to see my own role much better. I was not the ideological head of the Art and Beliefers, but I had a strong sense of my own personal imagery and struggled to find a home for it. The movement gave me a temporary home, like a plastic cup a Sunday school teacher plants a bean in for a child. It gave me a place to form roots, but ultimately was too restrictive to continue nourishing those roots. At a certain point, I subconsciously recognized, I think, that Dale Fletcher's vision did not fit my plastic cup, and I had to be replanted. But the movement had given me a bright start, a strong sense of esteem that I badly needed early on to find the courage to be more than a high school art teacher or a commercial artist or an animator for Walt Disney, as I had envisioned as ideal when I was a high school student. At a certain point, we were all transplanted in soils that suited us best, but to take the metaphor a bit further, hoping not to stretch it too far, our tendrils intertwined off and on from then on as we stretched for growth in our own spheres, and from time to time, the support from that intertwining has been extremely valuable. In fact, what is really interesting, this painting here is mine. I traded that with Dale for one of my flying machines in those days, about 1971-72. This was a sketch that he did. He did get a chance to do something within the church. He was given a commission to do a painting of Adam on Diamond, and this was his sketch for it. And what is interesting is even at that time, at the time that I saw it, I loved it. It had all of that pre-Raphaeliteness in that Vern talked about. There was always that brooding cloud on the horizon, and I even, in fact, saw the dark tree on this side as a subtle shadow of that black spot that had happened in his abstractions. In his treehouse paintings, for example, I saw personal reflections for the direction of my own work was going that Dale, I now realize, never intended or perceived for himself. I wonder if his own personal vision didn't succumb to the black spot that infested his abstract expressionist period. In us, possibly, he was living on borrowed time. Maybe even, if it isn't too pretentious to say this, borrowed light. I know that in his Provo Temple site painting, which he sat out in the middle of a field and painted day after day, and who was it that said the other day he would come in and his eyes would be all red from painting in the middle of the field. I remember when we'd talk about our things and he would talk about that painting. He said, always looking for angels above it. So that you could paint them in, but the angels always only appeared in the blades of grass. Ironically, Dale went on to ever stronger religious fervor, and as he did, his art became more vacant. Many years later, after his association with Dallas Anderson, another close friend who supported him later on in his vision, I saw a painting in Dallas's home of a harbor with boats that Dale had done at an earlier, later date. I was shocked by the uninspired tone and visual weak image. It was little more than a timid attempt by an uncommitted Sunday painter. And that hurt a lot because I had seen other things, and I realized then that Dale's vision was in a different place than mine. On the other hand, though I have stepped away from orthodox religious passion and acknowledged a deep-rooted skepticism that is much more comfortable for me than the giddy idealism of my early years as an artist, which I attempted to mask in religious conformity, for much of my life. Despite all this, the angels that always eluded Dale are beginning to show up in my hedonistic, humanistic canvases. I celebrate them as a real part of my own vision. They cling to my agnosticism like rays of hope. I only wish I could have shared a few with Dale. Especially since beginning to paint in the past 6 or 7 years, I've come to terms with my own personal vision. Its roots go back to then, exploring the deep subsoil of early visions, and it finds footing in the positive nature of the credos we voiced then with such naive passion and narrow perspective, yet also with a kind of laser clarity that is affirmed for me over and over with increased objectivity in time.
I notice you have some slides. Would you like to show them now?
Yes.
Okay. And then we'll have questions after the slides.
Curtain action.
Final light. This is a painting by Dale Fletcher dated 1976 while he was still at BYU. This is quite unlike almost anything he painted. It's a one-off painting, but it really tells you that Dale was leaving painting for painting and was using painting as research. He became a researcher and a writer, and I think that's perhaps why his artwork later became so vacant. This is dealing with the geometry and symmetry as it relates to the human form and the divine canon of the human body. That early on, in the first Art Belief Movement exhibition in 1966, one of the major pieces, The Plan by Trevor Saldi, was exhibited. This is not a good slide. It's at the BYU Museum now. Again, another Trevor Saldi dated 1966. Essentially, figurative painting was not a forte of Utah artists, almost unknown, and particularly any metaphysical or metaphorical spiritualist or visionary type painting was unknown. One thing that Trevor brought was this aspect. Again, the final painting is a 1974 painting by Trevor. By the early 70s, I think that he was really reaching his maturity as a painter. This is The Prodigal Son. Again, the use of the nude, which is another aspect that was eschewed by most Utah artists, was an element that was used in the Mormon Art and Belief Movement. This is a highly important painting. This is dated 1966. It's also called The Plan, The Eternal Plan, and it's by Gary Smith. And you see here that Gary was also interested in figurative art and continues to become a leading practitioner, probably the leading practitioner in Utah art of the use of the figure. The nude, the human, slightly draped human figure, used extremely metaphorically in this painting. The whole movement was basically a non-conventional alternative to the visitor center art and the church publication department art that we see so much. It's quite unacceptable. But now is this art basically did not open the way for later artists to use these kinds of subjects. Gary Smith and Dennis and Trevor veritably kicked down the door allowing people to do this. This painting is 1965. It's still in the collection of the artist. And it is it's a self-portrait of Gary. It's called The Decision, just about the time that he had converted to the church. This is a 26-year-old slide of a 26-year-old sculptor, Dennis Smith, in his studio, and this is the chicken coop that I mentioned in Alpine. It's Alpine's
City Group. This is a plaster, I believe, did you say this piece is destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Unfortunately, it's in a medium that doesn't, unless it's bronze, it doesn't really hold up. I probably couldn't afford to bronze it at that time too easily. Unfortunately, luckily, Dennis has a friend named Neil Hadlock, although they argue, our friends enough that had a foundry. He liked it so much, like the guy who bought the razor company, he bought the foundry. But anyway, this is very typical of Dennis's work that deals with, I think, the home and the family and reminiscences of youth. And the next piece here is a very interesting piece of Adam and Eve at the altar. This was a commission, was it your first commission from the LDS Church? And many of you might remember, yes, it was, remember this piece from the Visitor Center on the north side, in Temple Square on the North Visitor Center. And it's no longer there, but it was a memorable, very fine piece. And behind, you can see the brochure right up there in red, the First Art and Belief Movement, and the brochure with the four arrows of the Third Art and Belief Movement brochures. I believe that's it. Yeah. Good. Do we have the lights? And maybe I'd like to ask Dennis, I mean Gary, if he had anything to add. Do you have just a word of wisdom?
I wrote a statement also, if Vern asked, and I basically said what I
could.
Could you come up to the microphone?
I basically said in my written statement that I gave to Vern what I felt my contribution was. I was not the verbal philosopher. I was the person that seemed to produce. And I did. I was looking back through my material today, this morning, and a little earlier also, trying to put all this stuff together, helping Vern to help as much as possible. And I found I had painted somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 paintings in 3 years. Trying to, verbally put pictorial reference to all of these things that I was feeling. And luckily, I don't know why I did this, so I never do this, but luckily I actually wrote the title of the piece and the person that owns that piece, and I still have it in my files today, so I know where all of those paintings are. At least I did at one time, and I suppose they've kind of sifted away here and there. But probably my contribution more than anything was as being able to visually define in my mind what things were rather than so verbally define them.
It's 3:00, but why don't we take at least 2 questions before this is over and... Is anyone real?
How do you turn
that? Franz was more of was related to the Art and Belief group movement, very much like Ford Madox Brown was related to the Pre-Raphaelite movement. Had anticipated a few things, was slightly older than almost any member of the group, but was not really a member of the group, was to the side and like Ford Madox Brown, was sometimes critical, sometimes praising. Robert Marshall and Jim Christensen, who worked on the later movie, film. That's certainly Mormon art, but it would be more art from the packaged point of view. I really think that Trevor had it right. Mormon art has to be produced independently. It doesn't have to be. In fact, Jim Christensen, in my opinion, has produced some of the finest Mormon paintings, but they're very typical of the work that he did in illustrations. His Annunciation, his Garden of Gethsemane is probably the second best Garden of Gethsemane ever painted by a Latter-day Saint. I think Trevor Saldi's at the BYU is the strongest, but you know they're right there with each other. But it's a much more traditional format. We know him as a fantasy painter, but when he paints religious subject matter, he's very much the illustrator. I think it's absolutely important, I think, to have those annual exhibits. They're basically picking up where the Mormon Festival of Arts has left off. I think it's very important. I was happy to see a lot of more experimental approaches since the church is just being juried and they're not being purchased by the publications and advertising arms. Or the visitor center. I think there's greater diversity and stylistic approach, and I think we need that. Let everybody get into the act and create like. Gary said something as we were just before our meeting. He said the reason that their art doesn't seem to have changed that much in its positive direction is that it was first created way back in '66, very truthfully and sincerely. So there wasn't a real need to change, you know, the whole thing. I mean, there are certain new aspects to all of their work. It keeps growing. But I'm really happy with this because artists can really show what they believe and not what evidence...